Welcome to the Darrell McClain Show. I'm your host, Darrell McClain, and let's get into our episode.
Simply search for the T-Bone and Chick Brew podcast, available wherever fine podcasts are sold.
The Darrell McClain Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. You can get a membership for as little as $3 a month at www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcClain Show.
We talk about a lot of serious topics on this show. One very serious topic is women's health. One company that stood out to me was VSlay.com because the owner is very transparent about her own struggles in the women's health department and has great customer service, great deals, and frequent sales. You can check her out, her great customer service, products about women's health, and frequent sales at www.VSlay.com. That is www.VSlay.com. So let's get right into the show. Unfortunately, I had to start the show on a bit of a somber note. Everybody in the audience that follows me or has been following me for a long time knows that I am a practitioner of the gentle art of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Well, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu star Leandro Lo has been killed in Brazil. Lo was killed Saturday at a concert in São Paulo. His lawyer confirmed with a Sunday Brazilian news outlet, G1. Now, according to the report by MMA junkie, police officer Henrico Veloso is a suspect. The report also details a physical altercation between Lo and the Veloso. Veloso allegedly grabbed a bottle from Lo's table. After the BJJ star took the man down and held him. Once separated, Veloso allegedly pulled a gun and shot Leandro Lo in the forehead. Lo later was declared brain dead, the legal definition for death in Brazil. Now on the way to the hospital. Lo was 33 and he was a multiple time Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu world champion. His resume included victories in the World Cup, Pan American Championships, and Brazilian National Jiu-Jitsu Championships. His death sent shockwaves through the MMA combat sports community. MMA notable pays tributes to Lo on social media in the hours after the news broke as well. Now, according to the report also, Henrico was arrested Sunday after a judge approved his detainment for 30 days. A temporary sentence that could extend upon for 30 more days as he awaits testimony in court. Per the police report, Lo was shot in the head after dispute. And not only that, after he pulled out a gun, Lo was kicked in the head twice after the suspect fled. Lo was rushed to the local hospital and a warrant was issued for Veloso's arrest. Now, news outlets also reported that Veloso, who's 30, previously served 6 months in prison for disrespecting an official in 2017, but was acquitted of an alleged assault. Now, I do have to say I am reading different media accounts, so if you hear the same same verbiage a few times, it's for that reason. But Leandro Pinera de Nascimento Low was a Brazilian submission grappler and a third degree black belt and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu contender. Leandro Low was born May 11th, 1989 and died August 7th of 2022. As one of the most successful jiu-jitsu competitors of all time, Low held a record of 8 IBJJF World Championships and 8 in different weight classes, as well as victories in the Pan American Championships, European Championships, Brazilian National Championships, and Abu Dhabi World Pro. Leandro was born in Brazil in May 11, 1989. A boy named Low was born. He was a BJJ instructor and coach. Cineiro Custa founded Projecto Social Lutadora Pelo BIM for low income use. At the age of 14, he began training in martial arts at PSLPB. As a lightweight with the team Barbosa JJ, Low won his first IBJJF World Championship in 2005 as a blue belt. The following year, he won silver. Low missed the finals because of a terrible injury he suffered while he was a purple belt. Low obtained all of the Coastal's belts and was promoted to black belt in July of 2010. Fighting at lightweight, Low defeated Michael Laghini, who had been winless for the previous 3 years at the 2011 CBJJ Brazilian National Championships and the Abu Dhabi World Pro. It was in 2012 that Low won back-to-back Black Belt World Championships at the World Jiu-Jitsu Championships, taking home his first in 2012 and his second in 2013. Since 2011, Low has been unbeaten in Brazilian's Copa Poda Grand Prix, the biggest professional Jiu-Jitsu event. The two-time lightweight world champion attended the 2014 World Championships as a middleweight and won gold once more, as well as the Pan Ams and the Abu Dhabi Pro. Low was previously a two-time lightweight world champion. NS Brotherhood was founded by Low in 2015 after he left PSLPB. When Low moved up to medium heavyweight division, he won the 2015 World Pan Ams and the Abu Dhabi Pro Championships, adding to his 2016 gold medal haul for those three illustrious events. Now, when Low moved up to heavyweight in 2017, he won silver in both the heavyweight and absolute divisions of the World Championships, as well as a goal at the Pan Am Brazilian Nationals and the European Championships. A close friend of Low's, Marcus Buchecha, resolved to give Low the open class title, the only one that Low had not won, by relinquishing it in the final. It wasn't until 2022 that Low returned to the heavyweight division and won his 8th and final world title in the middleweight division. Low was hailed as one of the best pound-for-pound grapplers ever to grace the mat for his guard techniques. So after the tragic murder of Low, the Morumbi Cemetery in São Paulo held Low's funeral on August 9th of 2022. Members of Low's jiu-jitsu team, several of whom wore their gis, stood guard at his casket, and it was transported from the capital, the chapel, to his graveyard. In a shocking act of violence, Brazilian jiu-jitsu champion was shot, killed in San Pablo, promoting a large gathering of mourners dressed in traditional kimonos. After being shot in the head in the nightclub, Brazil's largest city, on Sunday, the world's greatest MMA fighter was pronounced dead at the hospital in San Pablo, Brazil. Low was laid to rest in a cemetery in Sao Paulo on Monday after the wake, attended by friends and admirers, including the renowned chef Alex Alto. To Folha de São Paulo, he was an icon in the sport, said jiu-jitsu fighter Marcela Lima, who wore her kimono to show her support. In a heartfelt tribute to her hero, the victim's mother. Fatima Lowe said on social media, "You made me feel like the most loved mother in the world. Thank you. I shall always miss you." The jiu-jitsu community gathered at a local police station late Sunday night to demand the arrest of the military police officer accused of killing Lowe. One of Brazilian's well-known samba pop groups, Grupo Pixoto, was performing at the time, and a cop later identified as Enrico Oliva allegedly shot jiu-jitsu champion in the face when an altercation broke out. Details like this have caused outrage and have served as reminders of Brazil's recent rise in violence as a cautionary tale about the risk of an ever-growing number of firearms being purchased by Brazilians. One of the greatest minds in jiu-jitsu, Professor John Danaher, said Leandro Lowe was unquestionably one of the greatest jiu-jitsu athletes of his generation and indeed in the history of the sport. 8 times he stood on the top of the jiu-jitsu world, most recently at the 2002 IBJJF World Championships. As an athlete, he excelled in all the major aspects of the game. As a man, he was friendly and animated, one of the greatest social characters of the game, and an unforgettable character. He was able to keep the rare balance in life between athletic excellence at the highest level, but at the same time be able to indulge in his other passions in life. It's easy on the path to greatness in the sport to get so obsessed that you ignore every other facet of life. Leandro was able to remain at the top across the multiple weight divisions for over a decade, but still live in a full and fun life outside of jiu-jitsu that made him one of the greatest characters of the game. His death is a reminder of the delicate nature of life and how all our plans and dreams have to be kept within the bounds of our mortality. For we never know the day or the hour of our end, and there is no denying that the iron decrees of our fate. Leandro made jiu-jitsu better, and he enriched the lives of all those who knew him. There is no better life than that. Camus said that the best, those whom the gods love the most, die young. End quote. You can kill a man, but you can't kill the memories of him. The jiu-jitsu world will always remember him as one of the very best and most loved in its pantheon. So rest in peace, Leandro Lowe. So just to also stick to some news as far as passing away, Judo Jean LaBelle passed away at the age of 89. It has truly been a sad week for the grappling community for several reasons, one is which passing of the true American legend Judo Jean LaBelle accomplished many things in his life, earning a 10th degree red belt in judo and a 10th degree black belt in Kyokushin Budokai and a 9th degree black belt in jiu-jitsu. He also trained extensively with the famous catch wrestlers like Carl Gulch, Louis Thiez, and Ed Strangler Lewis. LaBelle was a popular figure in the grappling community after competing in what has been regarded as the first televised MMA fight in America. He fought veteran boxer Milo Savage in 1963 in a rule set that aimed to bridge the gap between grappling and striking, eventually choking him unconscious to win. This started his involvement with MMA, where he served as a referee, judge, and even as a coach to the talent throughout the years. So rest in peace as well to Judo Jean LaBelle as he passes away at the age of 89. So now I got to make the transition to American politics. And of course, that is right now we're in the primary, so that is going to be about primarily focused on, at least if Republicans have their way, on President Joe Biden. And now historians have privately warned President Biden that American democracy is teetering. When Biden met with historians last week at the White House, they compared the threat facing America to the pre-Civil War era and the pro-fascist movements before World War II. President Biden paused last week during one of the busiest stretches of his presidency for a nearly two-hour private history lesson from a group of academics who raised alarms about the dire condition of democracy at home and abroad. The conversation, during a ferocious lightning storm on August 4th, unfolded as a sort of Socratic dialogue between the commander-in-chief and a select group of scholars who painted the current moment as among the most perilous in modern history for a democratic governance. According to multiple people familiar with the discussion who spoke of the condition of anonymity to describe a private meeting, comparisons were made to the years before the 1860 election when Abraham Lincoln warned that a house divided against itself cannot stand, and the lead up to the 1940 election when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt battled against rising domestic sympathy for European fascism and a resistance to the United States joining World War II. So the diversion was from Biden, part of a regular effort to use outside experts in a private White House meeting to help him work through his approach to multiple crises facing his presidency. Former President Bill Clinton spoke with Biden in May about how to navigate inflation and midterm elections. A group of foreign policy experts, including former Republican advisors, came to the White House in January to beef Biden on Russia before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. These meetings have come as Biden faces the isolation that's an endemic to his presidency, a problem that some Democrats say have been worsened by the coronavirus pandemic, which restricted visitors through much of the first year of his presidency, and by the insular quality of Biden's inner circle made up by staffers who have worked with him for decades. Biden, as the tabletop session, often spends hours asking questions and testing assumptions, participants say. Michael McFaul, a former U.S. ambassador to Russia under President Barack Obama, briefed Biden with other experts before Russia's invasion of Ukraine and before the president's 2021 meeting with Russian Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia in Geneva. They get out in their bubble, McCall said. I worked at the White House for 3 years before going to Moscow, and comparatively, I think they do that in a much more strategic way than we used to do it in the Obama administration. It feels that we are more engaged. McFaul was among a socially distanced group that met to discuss Ukraine in the East Room earlier this year, along with former diplomat Richard Haass, journalist Fareed Zakari, analyst Ian Bremmer, former National Security Council advisor Fiona Hill, and retired Admiral James G. Stravitis, a former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. Biden sat at the center of the dining table with experts gathered at either end to keep the presidential at the president at COVID safe 6 feet from the group, as some participants, including McPhill and Stravitis, appear remotely on screen. Biden began to brief them with brief comments and then spent about 2 hours asking questions. Then they really wanted the outside of the box thinking of, is there any way that this war, which will be horribly for everyone involved, can be stopped? Can we stop it? How can we stop it? Bremer said. All of my interactions with the White House in the last few years have been uniformly open, constructive, and really wanting to get my best sense of why they're getting it right and where they are not. Now, the White House spokesman Andrew Bates said the president values hearing from a wide range of experts. NCS spokesman Adrena Watson said, we're in regular touch with a diverse bipartisan coalition of experts and stakeholders on a variety of topics, including Russia's unprovoked war in Ukraine. At a news conference in January, Biden said a priority of his second year in office was to get more input from the academia, editorial writers, think tanks and other outside experts seeking more input, more information, and more constructive criticism about what should and shouldn't be doing, he told reporters. Some meetings have been more exclusives at a private lunch with Biden on May the 2nd. Clinton praised his successor's efforts to build a multinational coalition supporting Ukraine, but he also urged Biden to lean into speaking about his administration's efforts to battle inflation with the expectation that the price pressures would ease in the weeks before the midterm elections, according to people briefed on the exchange. Clinton suggested that Biden's positions himself to take credit for inflation reductions if they come. Clinton also urged Biden to create sharp policy contrasts with Republicans, latching specifically onto the policy proposals of Senator Rick Scott of Republican Florida, who had produced a five-year sunset on all federal laws, including Social Security and Medicare, and tax increases on many Americans who are not working. As it happened, the White House was already planning in a similar contrast, and the days later, Biden publicly laid into what he called Ultra MAGA agenda, a reference to the Make America Great Again movement that is organized around the former president Donald Trump. The historians Biden has invited to the White House generally take a longer view, placing his presidency in the context of America's path since the founding. Biden, who is 79, has seen nine presidents up to close, starting with Richard M. Nixon, and has signaled that he has thought about what makes some presidents more successful than others. The group that gathered in the White House map room last week was part of a regular effort by presidential historians to brief presidents, as it practiced its dates at least to as far back as the Reagan administration. Obama convened such groups multiple times, though the sessions fell out of favor under President Donald Trump. Following a similar meeting with Biden last spring, the August 4th gathering was distinguished by a relatively small size and the focus of participants on the rise of totalitarianism around the world and a threat to democracy at home. They included Biden's occasional speechwriter, John Meacham, journalist Anna Applebaum, Princeton professor Sean Wiltz, University of Virginia historian Alida Black, and President Hitch historian Michael Beschloss, White House senior advisor Anita Dunn, and head speechwriter Vinnie Reedy also sat at the table. Biden, who is still testing positive for the coronavirus, appeared on television monitor that was set up next to the room's fireplace, taking notes as he sat two floors up in the treaty room. And that is part of the White House residence. Senior advisor Mike Donilon also appeared on screen, said people familiar with the events said. During the discussion, a loud crack and thunder could be heard, which participants later found out coincided with the lightning strike that had killed, sadly, three people in Lafayette Square across the street from the White House. One person familiar with the exchange said the conversation was mostly a way for Biden to hear and think about the larger context in which his tenure is unfolding. He did not make any major pronouncements or discuss his plans for the future. A lot of the conversation was about the larger context and contest between the democratic values and institutions and the trends toward autocracy globally, the person said. Most of the experts in attendance have been outspoken in recent months about the threats they see to American democratic project after the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, the continued denial by some Republicans of the 2020 election results, and the efforts of the election deniers to seek state office. Beschloss, a president historian who regularly appears on NBC and MSNBC, has recently become more outspoken about what he sees the need for Biden to battle anti-democratic forces in the country. Quote, I think he's got to talk tonight about the facts that there are all in existential danger of having our democracy and our democracies around the world destroyed, Beschloss said in March on MSNBC before Biden delivered the State of the Union address. Welts, premiering author of The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson and Lincoln, also voiced alarm in recent months about the state of the country. We're on the verge of what Hamilton and the Federalists called the government by brute force, Welts told The Hill last month. Some of last week's discussion focused on similarities between today's landscape and the period between the leading up to World War II, when growing authoritarianism abroad found its disturbing echo in the United States as Germany's Adolf Hitler and Italy's Mussolini consolidated power in the 1930s. Reverend Charles Culling used his radio broadcast to spread a populist anti-Semitic messages in the United States. Senator Huey Long also rallied Americans against Roosevelt as he showed symptoms for a dictatorial style of government. Concerns about the anti-democratic trends have long animated Biden, who began his 2020 campaign by arguing that the battle for the soul of the nation was underway, to play on the phrase used by Manchin in the title of his 2018 book, The Soul of America, The Battle for a Better Natures. I'm sorry, The Battle for Our Better Angels. I do have that book, and it is pretty good. So that's John Meacham's book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. So Democrats broadly expect the same ideals will anchor Biden's reelection campaign and his, if he decides to move forward with one of his, especially if his Trump is his opponent. Biden has continued to bring up such themes in his public speeches, most recently in July, as he addressed the law enforcement group where he criticized former President Donald Trump for taking no immediate action as the rioters held an inspired attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, in an effort to overturn the results of the presidential election. Quote, "You can't be pro-insurrection and pro-democracy," Biden told the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. "You can't be pro-insurrection and pro-America."
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It goes without saying that this show does not happen without listener support. Support the Darrell McClain Show by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for $3. Or you can go to buzzsprouts.com/the Darrell McClain Show and hit the subscribe button and join there. Many ways to donate to the show. Independent media that won't reinforce tribalism. We have one planet. Nobody is leaving. So let us reason together. www.patreon.com/the Darrell McClain Show or go to Buzzsprouts and to the Darrell McClain Show and subscribe.
Since the 2020 election, it has been basically an article of faith that 2024 was pretty likely to be a rematch between President Biden and President Trump.
The question is, the radical left, would you shut up, man?
But there are signs that the bases of both presidents may be looking elsewhere as we inch closer to the 2024 campaign. Ever since 2020, Trump has, in many ways, been acting like a candidate.
Who knows? I may even decide to beat them for a third time, okay?
Advisors have told the Washington Post that Trump is eyeing a September announcement. Candidates do often announce very early for presidential campaigns, but they'll almost always wait until after a midterm election. There's no question that Trump remains very popular within the Republican Party, and any time a former president runs, you would expect them to have the inside track on the nomination. A New York Times poll showed around half of Republicans said that they wanted Trump to be their nominee. At the same time, we have seen some evidence that Trump could get a run for his money, particularly from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. And we have seen evidence that certain high-profile members of the party are at least willing to endorse against Trump in some key 2022 primaries. One of the subplots of the January 6th committee hearings is whether it might tempt Republicans to try to turn the page on Trump in 2024.
Just like everyone else in our country, he is responsible for his own actions and his own choices.
Not necessarily completely disown him, but maybe decide to move forward with somebody else. While the percentage of Republicans who want Trump to run again in 2024 might be a little bit lower than some people realize, for President Biden, it's exceptionally low. New York Times poll showed that just 26% of Democrats wanted him to run again, and 64% said that they would prefer their 2024 nominee to be somebody else. Biden has long insisted that he does intend to run in 2024, even though he'll be in his 80s.
My plan is to run for re-election. That's my expectation.
There have been concerns both in the broader Democratic Party and even among Biden loyalists about both his age and his ability to carry the party forward. given his declining approval ratings, which currently are among the lowest in history for a president entering his first midterm election. A review of history suggests that those numbers are very unusual, with a president's base almost always preferring that they would run again and be their party's nominee. The question from there is how much of an effort there will be within the party to try and push him out, maybe in the name of getting somebody who would be more popular on the ticket in 2024. At the same time, Biden has plenty of incentive to keep his hat in the ring and not suggest that he might bow out. A 2024 matchup between Biden and Trump would in some ways reflect what happened in 2016. In that election, only about 4 in 10 Americans had favorable opinions of both major party nominees, Trump and Hillary Clinton. The race wound up being decided by people who didn't like either of them, with those voters opting for Trump in large enough numbers to decide the race for him. And that New York Times poll reinforces the stakes of each of these men's decisions about whether to run in 2024.
I ran twice, I won twice, I did much better the second time than I did the first, believe it or not.
Because while Biden was among the most unpopular presidents at this juncture of his presidency, by virtue of Trump's unpopularity, Biden would still have a fighting chance, and perhaps that would be enough for him to try and give it a go in 2024. What's clear about 2024 is that plenty will depend upon the decisions that these two men make in the coming months.
I will just say this. I am one of the people that am remarkably uninterested with Joe Biden or Donald Trump relitigating the previous election. But there is an appetite for some people to have this stuff redone, and I don't really understand why. If the same voters still exist, obviously you got 1 million or so people who have passed away since the COVID pandemic started. So that's going to have an impact. Of course, if the numbers are correct, that a lot of those people were Trump supporters and they were in red states, that's going to have an impact. But if you have Donald Trump on the ballot again, and you have Joe Biden on the ballot again, I do not see, with us knowing everything we know about Donald Trump, seeing 4 years of his presidency, and everything we know about Joe Biden and seeing 4 years of his presidency, how anything is going to end up any different. Joe Biden is historically unpopular right now in the same way that Donald Trump is historically unpopular. I don't see any of that changing just because an election happens. I don't see anybody amped up to go out and vote for Joe Biden. I see them amped up to go out and vote against Donald Trump. And I see that the Roe v. Wade overturn decision has probably amped up the Democratic Party to go out in mass and vote. Now, the midterms is going on right now, and there's a raid that just happened on the president's, the former president's Donald Trump's house. And I think if Donald Trump was politically smart about this, it's a tactful thing to do, I would announce immediately that I was running for president to just go ahead and try to slow down these investigations, make them more political than they already seem of this raid that just happened. Speaking of that, let me get into the details of that raid now. But as I said, I do not see any reason, I don't have any appetite for a relitigation of Donald Trump versus Joe Biden. I don't think anything's going to be any different. You have two very polarizing figures on the left and on the right, for very different reasons, and very, very unpopular people. Nobody has a middle position on either one of these men, and I do not see that them running against each other again would do us any good. Joe Biden is gonna be 80 if he reruns, and I think if he wants to be like FDR, which I think he missed that boat, I think he would do better off for being like George Washington and stepping down from power while he still has control and passing that mantle on to somebody like a Pete Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar or any of the other young people in the Democratic Party. And that is not just for Democrats. I want to see them all gone. I want to see Joe Biden gone. I want to see Nancy Pelosi gone. I want to see Mitch McConnell gone. I want to see Lindsey Graham gone. I want to see Chuck Schumer gone. I want them all gone. These people who have sat in D.C., Washington, D.C., in the halls of power for years and years and years and have not delivered to its constituents. That's just my opinion. There are very low polls when it comes to these people. 16%. 16% is the approval rating of Congress. That's it. That is not enough to me for you to keep your job in any capacity.
Congress is at 16% with 82% of the American people disapproving of the work we are doing here. 16 think we're doing a good job. 82% think not. Further, according to a recent University of Chicago poll, a strong majority of Americans, and this is extremely important, and I hope members of Congress hear this, a majority of Americans believe that the government is, quote, corrupt and rigged against me, end of quote. People believe the government is corrupt and rigged against them. Further, according to a USA Today poll that came out last week, a very strong majority no longer believe that the Democratic or Republican parties are responding to their needs, and we need to move to a multi-party system. And I think what is most frightening in terms of where the American people are politically today is that there is actually a growing number of Americans who believe that they may have to take up arms against their own government in order to accomplish what they think needs to be done.
I don't think there's anything that I can say better than what had just been said. So now to the FBI raid of the 45th President of the United States. The latest of the dramatic twists in what the Trump FBI saga and how things are going. So the 45th president of the United States is actually under investigation for potential violations of the Espionage Act. The one potent fact was the most explosive bombshell on Friday as the saga of the FBI investigation to the former president Donald Trump took several new turns. The story has sidelined every other piece of news in the political world this week. Now, the starting gun was fired when Trump himself confirmed early reports of a search of his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida on Monday. The pace of developments has not eased since. Trump, being Trump, even news of possible crimes committed by him had a downside for Democrats. The passage of a major piece of legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, long sought by President Biden and his party, became a sideshow to the Trump-centric main event. Political insiders of every stripe are wondering what to make of the most recent discoveries and where the story goes from there. The possible crimes are as follows. Now, we know the FBI search of Trump's estate was premised on the investigation of three potential offenses. One of those possible charges has been widely predicted. It pertains to the concealment or removal of official documents. Another covers the destruction, alteration, or concealment of records with the intent to impede, obstruct, or influence an investigation. An intriguing charge given the number of other probes directed at former President Trump. The biggest shock came with the inclusion of a third possible offense under Section 793 of Title 18 of the U.S. Criminal Code. The language of the statute is complicated, but the main thrust is that it is a criminal offense for someone to misuse, mishandle, or fail to guard national security information that they believe could be to the injury of the United States or the advantage of any foreign nation. What that means exactly in relation to Trump is far unknown, though it appears on its face plausibly consistent with Thursday evening's Washington Post scoop that asserted investigators were looking for information about nuclear weapons. So the things we don't know
are the feverish speculation that has gripped Washington and partly is the result of an extraordinary nature of an FBI search of a former president's home, something that has never happened before. But it also is the consequence of situations in which many key details have been revealed in part, but not entirely. The revelation about the Espionage Act came with the release of two documents on Friday, the search warrant for the Mar-a-Lago and the inventory of the item seized. The previous day, Attorney General Merrick Garland had announced at his brief press conference that he wanted those documents unsealed. His request met with no opposition from the former president and his legal team. Importantly, however, neither the Department of Justice nor Trump's team expressed any wish to make the affidavit that underlies the search public. The document would give so much more insight into investigators' thinking since it had made their case to a federal magistrate for believing that a crime had been committed. Now, the inventory is key nevertheless. It asserts that among the items seized were numerous instances of classified material, including classified top secret and SCI documents, an abbreviation that refers to one of the highest levels of classification, top secret sensitive compartment of information. Now, the list also included such intriguing entries as info re-presidents of France, handwritten note, leather-bound box of documents, an executive order granting clemency to long-term Trump ally Roger Stone was also among the items taken. Now, the broader view is the 30,000-foot view is in which there is every new tidbit becomes ammunition in the nation's increasingly bellicose partisan wars. The past week has seen Trump critics gleefully at what they imagine to be his imminent indictment, if not imprisonment. And his diehard supporters are just as adamant that he is a victim of a nefarious plot by an ill-defined deep state. Now, Trump is arguing that the information in the possession at Mar-a-Lago was already declassified. The claim is sure to be scrutinized and tested. Now, the unusual couture of the staunchest allies is rallying around. Late Friday, Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene told reporters at the Capitol that she was on her way to file articles of impeachment against Merrick Garland. She accused the Attorney General of using his power to politically persecute Joe Biden's enemies. The current moment is only likely to become more febrile with the kind of rhetoric. It's dangerous enough as it is. On Thursday, a man was shot and killed by law enforcement in Ohio after allegedly trying to breach security at the FBI office in Ohio. The man was identified as Ricky Schiffer, a social media account, and that name had encouraged attacks on the FBI. Another post on the day, a Mar-a-Lago raid, hewed to a crossing of the Rubicon against which citizens should rise up. Quote, "We must not tolerate this one," the post said. "This time we must respond with force." On accounts bearing Sheriff's Sharifa's name, they also appear to indicate its author had been around the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Now, as for Trump, he faces legal dangers on several fronts. He repeatedly pled the fifth earlier this week during a deposition in a civil case, at least, he pled the fifth almost 400 times, and at least three other criminal probes could endanger him. Now, legal experts say that when it comes to the Mar-a-Lago matter, charges could be months away if they are passed, if they are pressed at all. Now, the former president has skated away from trouble many times before. He remains, in spite of it all, the favorite to win the GOP nomination in 2024 should he enter the race. But right now, the former president is once again sailing in unchartered waters.
We must save America. Whatever happened to the Republican Party backing the blue?
This is coming
Steve,
from
who
the top.
Went rogue? Who went rogue? They were following a search warrant. Nuclear weapons. We don't know if there are weapons, but if that is true, and they were just in the basement of Mar-a-Lago, that's kind of a big deal.
Well, certainly.
It will allow Medicare to negotiate lower prescription drug prices. And I, you know, if you are on a fixed income, if you're older, you love that, regardless of your political party.
You love how it sounds.
Deeply, deeply concerned about the politicization of the FBI and Biden's DOJ.
Well, of course, the FBI director was appointed by Donald Trump, the former president. But Congresswoman, and just out of curiosity, are you wearing Bermuda shorts right now?
You know, that was just a bit of audio from a thing called the recount. Pretty good. They make pretty good reels. I like it. But anyway, that was sent to me, and then it was titled "Steve Ducey is Broken," and that is because Steve Ducey is a journalist from Fox News, normally a hyper Republican, and I guess lately he's been going a bit off script, and I thought that the clip was somewhat funny. The thing about the FBI raid that was interesting is all the political realignments that ended up happening around it. Now, of course, none of those people, I believe, are good faith actors. I saw the Candace Owens come out and talk about how we need to defund the FBI, Marjorie Taylor Greene saying something similar. And I just watched the people on the left start to say, I'm definitely okay with the defunding of the police. And we could start off with the FBI. The right was saying we need a church-style commission on the FBI. And if you are unfamiliar with what that is, the Church Commission was a commission that happened. And so this is after the Civil War, the Civil Rights era, and it showed a lot of the things the FBI had done, from COINTELPRO and the tapping various civil rights leaders, putting in informants, sowing discord amongst different leaders in African American communities by planting false information, et cetera, et cetera. And when the Church Commission came out, showed assassinations, all kinds of stuff. It really changed the way Americans viewed the FBI and the CIA. And in my opinion, it really changed the FBI after the J. Edgar Hoover era for the better for many years. And I have no problem following what Marjorie Taylor Greene said and what Candace Owens said, and having this church style commission, and to see exactly what the FBI is doing. But that is because I do not think that any person is inherently correct, or by their very nature inherently incorrect. I think that these are human beings, and human beings are flawed people. So I don't put any organization or institution in a place where they are above reproach. So I hope that the newly found distrust in some of the institutions sticks, and it doesn't just become a a talking point that passes away the second Republicans get back in power, and the FBI is then used to go after people that they like, or that they don't like, I should say. Now, I don't want to make it seem like everybody's down with the party, criticizing the FBI, et cetera, et cetera, because I have seen lawmakers condemn Donald Trump and the GOP to his attack on the FBI for the Mar-a-Lago search from on the left and on the right. So that's just, we'll just leave that where it is. So the show started off on a somber note, and unfortunately, I have to somewhat end with some disturbing news. Salman Rushdie was stabbed some 10 times on Friday, and he was badly wounded. His situation seemed like it was precarious, but he is off a ventilator now and has started to recover. Now, Salman Rushdie's agent said Sunday that the writer, who was attacked on Friday after years under threat, was beginning a slow journey of healing. So the author, Salman Rushdie, was stabbed roughly 10 times on Friday, and he has now been removed from a ventilator and is on the mend, his agent said on Sunday. Quote, the road to recovery has begun, Andrew Wally, the agent, said in a text message. It will be long. The injuries are severe, but his condition is headed in the right direction. Salman Rushdie, who spent decades under prescription by Iran, was attacked on stage minutes before he was to give a talk at the institution in Western New York. I think it's called the Chattanooga Institution in Western New York. Heidi Martyr, a 24-year-old New Jersey man, was arrested on the scene and charged with second-degree attempted murder and assault with a weapon. In court on Saturday, prosecutors said that the attack on the author was premeditated and targeted. Martyr had traveled by bus to the intellectual retreat and purchased a pass that allowed him to attend the talk Mr. Rushdie was giving on Friday morning, according to prosecutors. Nathaniel Barmer, the public defender, entered a not guilty plea on his behalf. Martyr was held without bail, and his next court appearance is scheduled for Friday at 3 p.m. Rushdie has been put on a ventilator, the evening he was attacked after undergoing hours of surgery at a hospital in Erie, Pennsylvania. Mr. Wheeling said that Rushdie might lose an eye. His liver had been damaged and the nerves in his arm were severed. On Sunday, Rushdie's son, Zafir Rushdie, said his father remained in critical condition and was receiving extensive treatment. He said the author was able to speak a few words. Though his life-changing injuries are severe, his usual feisty and defiant sense of humor remains intact, Zafir Rushdie said in a statement. We are so grateful to all of the audience members who bravely leapt to his defense and administered first aid, along with the police and the doctors who have cared for him, for the outpouring of love and support from around the world. Salman Rushdie had been living under threat of assassination since 1989, about 6 months after the publication of his novel, The Satanic Verses. The book fictionalized parts of the life of the Prophet Muhammad with depictions that offered some Muslims who believe the novel, depictions offended some Muslims who believe the novel to be blasphemous. So the Ayatollah Khomeini, who led Iran after the 1979 revolution, issued an edict known as a fatwa on February 14, 1989. It ordered Muslims to kill Salman Rushdie. So Friday's attack happened in the center dedicated to learning and reflection. A video of TikTok was subsequently taken down. It showed a chaotic scene moments after the attacker had jumped onto the stage at a normally placid institution. Mr. Rushdie had been living a relatively openly after years of his semi-clandestine existence, had just taken a seat to give the talk when the man attacked him. A crowd of people immediately rushed to where the author lay on the stage to offer aid. Stunned members of the audience could be seen through the amphitheater. While some were screaming, others got up and slowly moved towards the stage. People started to congregate in the aisles. A person could be heard yelling, "Oh my God," repeatedly. Security at the Chattanooga Institution is minimal, and its main amphitheater, which regularly hosts popular musical acts and celebrity speakers, and where Mr. Rushdie was scheduled to speak, there are no bag checks or metal detectors. Little is known about Mr. Matter, the man accused of the attack at the house listed at his residence in Fairfield, New Jersey. There was a car in the driveway, but the shades were drawn and no one answered the door on Sunday. Many of his neighbors said that they did not know him or his family, although some residents, when shown a photograph of him, said they recognized him as someone who would walk around the neighborhood with his head down, never making eye contact. In Lebanon, the mayor of Yaron, a village on the southern border with Israel, said that Mahdar's father lives there and that authorities have been trying to reach him without success. The father lives in a stone house in the village's center and tends to flock of goats and sheep, the mayor said. He's refusing to see anyone or even open the doors for us, the mayor said in a phone interview referring to the father. In Bell Calif, California, just outside of Los Angeles, Juan Gonzalez said that Mr. Martyrs had a childhood friends with her son, had been childhood friends with her son, Uriel Aberdeen, when his family lived in the community, which has a large Muslim and Hispanic population. Ms. Gonzalez said in an interview in Spanish that she had fond memories of Martyr. His family keeps a large statue of the Virgin of Guadalupe encased in a glass box on their porch, and she said a young Mr. Martyr understood their veneration. He was respectful of our Catholic religion, Mr. Gullis said. That's how I knew him. That's how my family knew him. Now, this is a tragedy, to say the least. I knew about Salman Rushdie from his friendship from the late, his friendship with the late Christopher Hitchens. And it's when I found out about the fatwa given against Salman Rushdie for the crime of writing a work of fiction. And that was part of my initial critique of these types of dangerous organized religions. And you would, the novel, The Satanic Verses, is written in 1988, and it is shocking to me and sad as well that all the way in 2023 that fatwa still stands, and it has no imam or has come and said that it's no longer exists, said it's invalid, etc. And that is a problem. Christopher Hitchens said about this when he was alive, when the Ayatollah Khomeini offered money in his own name without shame for the suborning of murder of a novelist. The Cardinal, Archbishop of New York, the Chief Rabbi of Israel, the Archbishop of Canterbury all condemned what? The novel, the author, for blasphemy. Now get used to this, because you may be living in the last few years where you can complain about it. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, the barbarianism are not at the gate. The barbarians are in the gate. They are well inside. And who hell opened the door for them? And I think we all know the answer to that. Other religious people did. And I bring this up because this week I heard a crazy person say that they wanted this nationalism, religious nationalism, Christian nationalism to be around, to come to fruition in the United States. And I have to say this unequivocally, that Christian nationalism will lead and is almost no different than fascism. Christianity, in its inception, is supposed to be a private thing. Christianity, at its core, was punished by the state. The Jesus of Nazareth was killed by the Roman Empire. So the notion that you can take that and make it a religion of the state is only going to be corrosive and corrupting to the private practice of what is supposed to be a thing, this very personal experience. Salman Rushdie used to have a very extensive security detail. I don't know why he doesn't seem to have it anymore, but I think, sadly, it's something that is going to have to be given back because of things like this. Salman Rushdie has always been a champion of free speech at a time when I think we need it very, very badly. And I'm going to end the show with just a old Salman Rushdie quote, and we'll get to hear a bit of him in his own words to understand his brilliance. I read the Satanic Verses myself, and there was another book. You know, he's obviously written many novels, but a book he wrote called Shalimar the Clown that I thought was very good as well. And so I think now the best we can do, we can't go back in time and stop this attack from happening, but we can go out and support the work of him and people like him who have been trailblazers and truth-telling, and as we see now, punished for it. Universities are safe places for thought, not safe places from thought. And that is a famous quote from Salman Rushdie.
The Satanic Verses. They bought it not to read, but to burn. 1,000 Muslims gathered in Toronto on Sunday. Their call, ban the book, and justice for Rushdie.
To slander the saintly personalities of his family and his noble companions, radiallahu anhum, is ta'an fi deen. To malign the sanctifying rituals of Islam is ta'an fi deen. And ta'an fi deen is blasphemy, and blasphemy is a capital crime in Islam, punishable by death.
2 months ago, the first book burnings in Bradford, a mill town in northern England. It's an unlikely place to be fomenting revolution.
If somebody swear at ourselves, we will tolerate. If somebody swear at our parents, we will tolerate. But if somebody swear at our prophet and our big persons, we won't tolerate.
Thousands marched in Bradford. Ordinarily, it's a quiet city of 500,000. The Muslim community is strong, 65,000 strong. There are 38 mosques and Muslim schools. In this community, boys and girls are educated separately according to Islamic principle. And here, the rules of Islamic law are known even to the young.
I think it's a stupid thing to write about, because you are supposed to write about religions in the Muslim world.
Muslim leaders say Rushdie's book portrays Islam's most holy figures as men who consort with prostitutes. In Bradford, the men at the mosques are enraged. Director of mosques, Sher Azam.
This book, some people call it a freedom of speech and freedom of expression. But there is a great deal of difference between freedom of speech and freedom of abuse, freedom of insult, and freedom of provocation. This book contains everything which ridiculizes and insults Islam.
But author Salman Rushdie claims his book was not an attack on the Muslim faith.
What I was trying to say, there are two sections which say when a new idea comes into the world, a great idea like Islam, it has to answer two questions. One is, what do you do when you're weak? And the other is, what do you do when you're strong? That's to say, when you're weak, do you compromise in order to survive? Or are you bloody-minded and determined? In which case, most likely, you'll be destroyed. But if you're not destroyed, you become something huge. And the second question is, when you become something huge and when your enemies are at your mercy and all that, you know, is do you forgive them? Are you tolerant?
He has portrayed our prophet like an animal. and we object to that strongly. Because
Mohammed Sadiq is a British Muslim scholar.
God sends messengers, and God puts in messengers special qualities, and there are these qualities which hinder any satanic influences. So Prophet Muhammad, he was a pure prophet.
People say that I've called Muhammad's wives prostitutes. It's not true. I've done no such thing. What I did do in the Jahiliyyah section after the return to the city was to counterpoint the haram of Muhammad, of Mahound in the novel, in which it's clearly stated that the real haram was composed of wives living chastely with him, and to counterpoint that with a profane world of this decrepit poet who hides out at this brothel where people take the names of the prophet's wives. You know? And to say, here is a sacred world, here is the profane world, you know? Here is the moral Puritan world, here is the earthy debased world, you know, and to make them images, mirror images of each other, in order to contrast them.
Well, it didn't wash in Pakistan. The satanic verses has been banned there and in half a dozen other countries. But at the same time, some Muslims are struggling to understand what Rushdie is saying.
I had trouble with some chapters, especially the scene when the prophet tries to make love to the angel. And that was a revelation scene. So I said, I can't take that. It was too much for me.
Fadia Fakir is a well-known Muslim writer.
I'm rationalizing about the whole thing. And I asked myself this following question, will I finish the book? And I said, yes, I will, because I like it. Why did I have trouble with the scene? I realized that I had trouble with the scene because it was pushing me or urging me to re-examine my position towards history.
It seems to me completely legitimate that there should be dissent from orthodoxy, not just about Islam, but about anything, you know, from conservative politics. You know, that's a kind of orthodoxy under which we all live at the moment. It seems very important there should be dissent from that. I think, you know, if there were radical politics with the orthodoxy in this country, I think it would be important that there should be dissent from that. You know, I think it seems to be very, one of the things that a writer can do is to say, here is the way in which you're told you're supposed to look at the world. You know, but actually there are also some other ways.
If he's not killed first, Muslim leaders think Rushdie should be charged under Britain's hoary old laws of blasphemy.
We are going to cause the Home Secretary to act, and we are going to lobby the members of Parliament to pass a bill so that the law of blasphemy can be strengthened, so that it will enable us to proceed in course of law to have this book banned permanently and to prevent the publication of such blasphemous books in future.
The blasphemy law is not something that belongs to the Middle Ages. 10 years ago, the House of Lords upheld a fine of $1,000 for the publisher of a gay magazine convicted for the way he wrote about Christ. The gay publication in Britain had portrayed Jesus and the apostles as a bunch of raucous homosexuals engaged in some very lurid acts. And the Muslims feel pretty much the same way about what's been said in this book. But the difference is, the blasphemy laws in Britain are very specific. They speak about Christianity and the Anglican Church. Say what you will about Mohammed, the Pope, the Torah, but don't mess with Jesus.
I'll kill him in a second, you know, I won't leave him to be alive.
You want the millions or you kill him
for
nothing?
No, I don't want any money because I am a Muslim. This is my duty, I have to kill him.
Because he used bad language about
religion.
We would like to have this book banned because it is so filthy, it is so obscene. We want to tell the Canadian public to see the horrible things that are in their book. We want to save their children as well as our children from the For instance, he is going to, in a dream sequence, he used the names of our prophet's wives as prostitutes. He has referred to the Kaaba, the holiest shrine of Islam. He has compared it to a brothel. He has called the Prophet Abraham as a bastard. And there are so many other very abusive terms and language that he has used. And we feel that this is very offensive. This is not literature. It cannot be literature. Anybody who thinks this is literature obviously has to have their standards re-examined once again.
Why not use the law? There's a law of blasphemy.
But in Britain, the blasphemy law is confined only to the protection of the Anglican faith. In fact,
Muslims are complaining precisely about this. Whether in Canada or in Britain, a law cannot be confined only to one particular religion or one particular faith. A law to be a law has to be universal.
And the difference is Britain. You may not like the law, but the Archbishop of Canterbury proceeds by that. He doesn't put a contract out of the guy who wrote the stuff.
Let me tell you something. It is not simply a matter of saying something. I can assure you that if somebody was going to say, write something nasty about, let's say, the Anglican Church, first of all, that kind of material, that kind of material will never be published by any publisher. That would be
Look it. That's not the issue. These guys behind you are saying they want to kill the guy for what he wrote.
Yeah, sure.
You can make a reasonable argument to me about freedom of speech, but surely you ruin your point when you start putting a hit out on the guy. What do you think about this? We're all interested in equality of religion around here.
We want equality. The fact is that the book is hurting the sentiments. We have to have a balance here. And, you know, we cannot be compromising freedom of speech with the dignity of a group. That's wrong. Because we're a multicultural society. And if we want to be multicultural, we have to reason and respect others.
What do you think about killing Rushdie? A lot of these guys behind you say he should be killed.
Yeah, there's a procedure, and just not a law has gone through. We have to follow the procedure.
Right.
I mean, we should not be going out and killing, because that is wrong. That is injustice. He must have a trial. He has a right to a trial. And then any laws that are in effect will be placed. But we have to look at it in the case of this country.
We'll treat Islam and we'll treat Mohammed the way the law in Britain treats Jesus and the Anglican Church.
There has to be equality. If there's an equality, you're going to see this and you're going to see more.
So that particular clip was way back from 1989, and it was called Whose Freedom, Whose Speech? And it was done by the Fifth Estate, CBC Radio Canada, and a part of a Canadian public broadcast service.
Storytelling techniques in the Quran. No, the football team is taught the passwords by terrible fate to always finish just outside the important positions. But first of all, the Quran, as you know, is less narrative than the Old and New Testaments, much less narrative. Only about, I would say, about a third of the Quran tells stories. You know, a lot of the Quran is law-giving, and a lot of the Quran is kind of fulminations against the unbeliever. And there's sort of three major sections of writing in the Quran. One is, if you're an unbeliever, you will die and go to hell. The other is, this is how you should live, law. And the third is narrative. Now, the narrative sections, blasphemy coming. The narrative sections are highly derivative from not just from the Old and New Testaments, but actually from the versions of Bible stories that were told in Arabia at the time by Nestorian Christians. The cult of Nestorian Christianity was more or less only in the Arabian Peninsula. And one of the things that Nestorian Christians did was they ran a lot of the oases. They were like the innkeepers. And of course, the Prophet Muhammad, before he was a prophet, was a very successful merchant, and he was trading, you know, on the caravan routes. And the first places he would have heard Bible stories would have been at the oases in Nestorian versions. And the versions in the Quran are more or less identical to the Nestorian Christian versions. So, for example, the story of Jesus, in the chapter in the Quran, which is called Maryam, Mary, which is where the story of Jesus Christ is in the Quran, Jesus Christ is born in an oasis under a palm tree. And that is exactly the Nestorian variation of the Christian story that was in use at the time. So, of course, if you believe that the Quran is the uncreated word of God, then what I'm saying is blasphemy. If you believe that it's a historical document, then you can see the way in which the experience of the prophet influenced the telling of the tale, then this stuff makes complete sense. You know, so what I'm saying is that's the narrative aspect of the Quran. It either recapitulates what we know from the Old Testament, or it offers variations, local variations, which pre-existed, which predate the Quran. For me, one of the real sadnesses is that, you know, I think the thing that is really interesting about Islam is that it's the only great religion born inside recorded history. You know, that this is the one where we know who the Prophet was, where he lived, what his economic situations were, what his family was, who his wife was, what he did for a living. You know, we know a great deal about his character. We know a lot about the social and economic situations of Arabia at the time. And we can see how all of that is relevant to the ideas that are expressed in the Quran. But that historical approach, that approach of looking at the Quran as an event inside history, is prohibited by Islamic orthodoxy. Because if this is the word of God, then presumably God is not affected by the social economic conditions in the Arabian Peninsula in the 7th century. So all of this stuff is irrelevant. So it means that something which really can be intelligently studied is very often not intelligently studied because of these anathemas. But anyway, that's a short answer.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for as little as $3 a month. Again, that's www.patreon.com/The Darrell McLean Show. The Darrell McLean Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. Get a membership and support independent media at www.patreon.com/The Darrell McLean Show.